6. Your CEO is MIA. Apparently, the Buddha's famous discourse on the not-self didn't immediately convert everyone to his way of thinking. Sometime after delivering it, according to Buddhist scripture, he runs into a man named Agivesana, a braggart who has assembled a large audience to watch him vanquish the Buddha in a debate about the self. Agivesana begins the proceedings by challenging the Buddha's claim that the self can't be found in any of the five aggregates. He declares, "Form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, mental formations are myself, consciousness is myself." This is a pretty blatant provocation, a direct assault on the Buddhist's worldview. But the Buddha, being the Buddha, remains calm. He says, "Very well then, Agivesana, I will cross-question you on this matter." If you've read many of the Buddha's discourses, you know that Agivesana's convictions will not survive the ensuing dialogue in good shape. The only question is which rhetorical tool the Buddha will use to dispel his interlocutor's confusion. Turns out the answer is the king metaphor. The Buddha asks, "Would a consecrated noble warrior king, such as King Pasandai of Kosala, or King Ajatasattu Vidheputta of Magadha, wield the power in his own domain to execute those who deserve execution, to fine those who deserve to be fined, and to banish those who deserve to be banished?" "Yes, Master Gotama," answers Agivesana. "He would wield it, and he would deserve to wield it." The Buddha then says, "What do you think, Agivesana? When you say, 'Form is myself,' do you wield power over that form? May my form be thus, may my form not be thus?" Agivesana says nothing. The Buddha repeats the question. Agivesana remains silent. Now the Buddha pulls out the big guns. He reminds Agivesana that when anyone doesn't answer when asked a legitimate question by the Tathagata, the Buddha, up to three times, his head splits into seven pieces, right here. At that point, Agivesana looks up and ominously sees a spirit with an iron thunderbolt in hand. The spirit is aptly named Thunderbolt in Hand. The spirit speaks up, warning that if Agivesana doesn't answer when asked a legitimate question by the Blessed One up to three times, I will split his head into seven pieces right here. Thus incentivized, Agivesana answers the Buddha's question. "No, Master Gotama, he doesn't," he admits, "have complete power over his body." The Buddha then runs through the other aggregates, feeling, perception, and so on. Agivesana sees that no, he doesn't have the power over any of these things that a king has over his domain. So the Buddha has made his point. You, the you that experiences feelings and perceptions and entertains thoughts, isn't really in complete control of these things. If you think that somewhere inside your head there's a kind of supreme ruler, a chief executive, well, there's some question as to where exactly you would find it. 2,500 years later, the science of psychology is talking the Buddha's language. Well, not exactly his language. Psychologists don't often assert that you're not the king of your personal domain, since these days there aren't many kings who wield actual power over their own domains. Psychologists use more modern terminology. As Robert Kurzban, a professor of psychology at Penn, puts it, "You aren't the president, the central executive, the prime minister." This is a matter of nearly unanimous agreement among psychologists. The conscious self is not some all-powerful executive authority. In fact, according to modern psychology, the conscious self has even less power than Agivesana attributed to it after the Buddha clarified his thinking. Agivesana was just acknowledging that, on reflection, the various aggregates aren't under complete control. After all, if they were, then, as the Buddha was known to ask, why would they cause so much suffering? Modern psychology is making a stronger point. It's basically saying, you know how, on reflection, you conclude, along with Agivesana, that you're not in total control? Well, you're actually in even less control than you conclude on reflection. Unless maybe by on reflection you mean upon doing the kind of reflection you're doing as you approach the end of a one-week silent meditation retreat. If the retreat works as intended, by that point your mind is much calmer than usual, and you are viewing its contents much more objectively than usual. And some of the contents of your consciousness that you normally think of yourself as generating seem to be getting generated by something other than you. More than once I've heard a meditation teacher say, "Thoughts think themselves." By the end of a retreat, oddly, that can start to make sense. So if the conscious mind isn't in control, what is in control? As we'll see, the answer may be nothing in particular. The closer we look at the mind, the more it seems to consist of a lot of different players, players that sometimes collaborate, but sometimes fight for control, with victory going to the one that is in some sense the strongest. In other words, it's a jungle in there, and you're not the king of the jungle. The good news is that, paradoxically, realizing you're not king can be the first step toward getting some real power. Of course, it's hard to admit you're not king, and that's not just because king seems like a great thing to be. It's because we feel like we're king. We feel that our conscious self is in charge of our behavior, deciding what to do and when. But a number of experiments over the past few decades have cast doubt on this intuition. Of two minds. Among the most dramatic are the famous split-brain experiments. These were done with people whose left and right brain hemispheres had been separated via surgery that severed the bundle of fibers connecting them. Typically, the purpose of the surgery was to control seizures in case of severe epilepsy. It turns out that this surgery has little effect on behavior. Under normal circumstances, people with split brains act normally. But back in the 1960s, the neuroscientists Roger Sperry and Michael Gazzaniga devised clever experiments that led split-brain patients to behave strangely. The key was to confine information to a single hemisphere by presenting it to only half of the patient's visual field. If, for example, a word is presented only to the left visual field, which is processed by the right hemisphere, it won't enter the left hemisphere at all, since the hemispheres have been surgically separated. It's the left hemisphere that, in most people, controls language. Sure enough, patients whose right hemisphere is exposed to, say, the word nut, report no awareness of this input. Yet their left hand, which is controlled by the right hemisphere, will, if allowed to rummage through a box containing various objects, choose a nut. That finding alone could make you start questioning traditional notions of the conscious self. Now consider this one. When the left hemisphere is asked to explain behavior initiated by the right hemisphere, it tries to generate a plausible story. If you send the command walk to the right hemisphere of these patients, they will get up and walk. But if you ask them where they're going, the answer will come from the left hemisphere, which wasn't privy to the command. And this hemisphere will come up with what, from its point of view, is a reasonable answer. One man replied, plausibly enough, that he was going to get a soda. And the person who comes up with the improvised explanation, or at least the person's left hemisphere, the part of the person that's doing the talking, seems to believe the story. In one experiment, an image of a chicken claw was shown to the patient's left hemisphere, and a snow scene was shown to the right hemisphere. Then an array of pictures was made visible to both hemispheres, and the patient was asked to choose a picture. The patient's left hand pointed to a shovel, presumably because a snow scene had been seen by the hemisphere that controls the left hand, and snow is something that gets shoveled. The right hand pointed to a chicken. Gazzaniga recounts what happened next. Then we asked why he chose those items. His left hemisphere speech center replied, "Oh, that's simple. The chicken claw goes with the chicken," easily explaining what it knew. It had seen the chicken claw. Then, looking down at his left hand pointing to the shovel, Without missing a beat, he said, "And you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." Again, the part of the brain that controls language had generated a coherent, if false, explanation of behavior, and apparently had convinced itself of the truth of the explanation. The split-brain experiments powerfully demonstrated the capacity of the conscious self to convince itself that it's calling the shots when it's not. However, this demonstration was done with people who don't have normal brains. How about the rest of us, whose two hemispheres aren't separated? Do our brains actually make use of this capacity for self-deception? There is good reason to believe the answer is yes. In one much-cited experiment, the psychologists Richard Nisbet and Timothy Wilson asked shoppers to appraise 4 pairs of pantyhose and choose the best pair. It turned out people had a strong tendency to choose the pair on the far right. But when asked why they had chosen that pair, they didn't say, "because it's on the far right." They tended to explain their choices in terms of the quality of the pantyhose, sometimes going into detail about the fabric, the feel, and so on. Unfortunately for these explanations, the 4 pairs of pantyhose were identical. Psychologists have devised various ways to get people to do things without being aware of why they're doing them. A common technique is to present information subliminally. For example, to flash a word or an image on a screen for a small fraction of a second, not long enough for conscious awareness to set in. In one study done in Britain, subjects were told they would be given a monetary reward according to how hard they squeezed a hand grip in a series of trials, and that the stakes would vary from trial to trial. As they awaited a trial, watching the screen that would tell them how hard they had managed to squeeze the grip, an image of a coin was flashed on the screen, either a penny or a pound. Even when the image was shown subliminally, the stakes influenced how hard the subjects squeezed the grip. This experiment had a second dimension. These subjects were having their brains scanned. The scientists paid special attention to a brain region that is associated with motivation and emotion, and is thought to encode information about rewards. This part of the brain was more active when the monetary reward was higher, and that was true regardless of whether the information about the reward had been presented subliminally or had been left on the screen long enough to enter consciousness. The scientists wrote, "Consistently, the same basal forebrain region underpinned subliminal and conscious motivation." But is conscious motivation really the right term? That could be taken to mean that the motivation originates with conscious volition. And this experiment suggests a different scenario. The actual brain machinery that translates incentive into motivation is the same, regardless of whether you're consciously aware of the incentive and consciously experiencing the translation. So maybe the conscious awareness doesn't really add anything to the process. In other words, maybe it's not so much conscious motivation as consciousness of motivation. With or without conscious awareness, the same physical motivational machinery seems to be doing the heavy lifting. Sure, you might feel as if your awareness of the incentive is what led you to strengthen your grip, but what this experiment suggests is that maybe this is an illusion. That's not the only possible interpretation, but it's a salient one, and it's one the Buddha would probably warm to. You think you're directing the movie, but you're actually just watching it. Or, at the risk of turning this into a metaphor that's impossible to wrap your mind around, the movie is directing you, unless you manage to liberate yourself from it. Questions about how in control the conscious mind really is have now been raised from a lot of experimental angles. In a famous series of experiments first done in the early 1980s by Benjamin Libet, researchers monitored the brains of subjects while they chose to initiate an action. The researchers concluded that the brain was initiating the action before the person became aware of deciding to initiate it. This body of research is still coalescing. Not all the findings will hold up in the long run, as the experiments are repeated. And in some cases, including the Libet studies, there are unsettled questions of interpretation. Still, at a minimum, it seems fair to say that the role of our conscious selves in guiding behavior is not nearly as big as was long thought. And the reason this role was exaggerated is that the conscious mind feels so powerful. In other words, the conscious mind is naturally deluded about its own nature. The Darwinian Benefits of Self-Delusion. So if you're a Buddhist philosopher, you may feel vindicated, but you may also feel puzzled. Why would natural selection design a brain that leaves people deluded about themselves? One answer is that if we believe something about ourselves, that will help us convince other people to believe it. And certainly it's to our benefit, or more precisely, it would have been to the benefit of the genes of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, to convince the world that we're coherent, consistent actors who have things under control. Remember the guy whose right hemisphere was told to walk, and whose left hemisphere, when asked where he was going, said he was going to get a soda? His answer wasn't really true, but it does inspire a kind of confidence in him. He seems like a guy who is in charge of himself, who doesn't go around doing things for no good reason. Compare him with a guy who offers a more truthful account. I don't really know why I got up or where I'm going. Sometimes I just do stuff for reasons that make no sense to me. If those two guys were your neighbors in a hunter-gatherer village, which one would you want to go hunting with? Which one would you want to become friends with? During human evolution, the answers to such questions mattered. If you were thought unworthy of collaboration and friendship, your genes were in trouble. In short, from natural selection's point of view, it's good for you to tell a coherent story about yourself, to depict yourself as a rational, self-aware actor. So whenever your actual motivations aren't accessible to the part of your brain that communicates with the world, it would make sense for that part of your brain to generate stories about your motivation. Of course, coherence of motivation, though a desirable quality in a friend or collaborator, isn't by itself decisive. If someone has clear and consistent goals, but always fails to reach them, or fails to contribute much to team endeavors, or doesn't keep promises, he or she won't be overloaded with friends and collaborators. So you would expect us to tell and believe not just coherent stories about ourselves, but flattering stories about ourselves. And by and large, we do. In 1980, the psychologist Anthony Greenwald invented the term benefactance to describe the way people naturally present themselves to the world as beneficial and effective. Lots of experiments since then have shown that people not only put out this kind of publicity about themselves, but actually believe it. And they could be right. There are beneficial and effective people in the world. But one thing that can't be the case is that most people are above average in these regards. Yet study after study has shown that most people do think they're above average along various dimensions, ranging from athletic ability to social skills. And this sort of self-appraisal can firmly resist evidence. One study of 50 people found that on average they rated their driving skill toward the expert end of the spectrum, which would be less notable were it not for the fact that all 50 had recently been in car accidents, and 2/3 of them had been deemed responsible for the accidents by police. If there's anything we're more impressed by than our competence, it's our moral fiber. One finding among many that drive this point home is that the average person believes he or she does more good things and fewer bad things than the average person. Nearly half a millennium after Montaigne died, science has validated the logic behind his perhaps too modest remark. I consider myself an average man, except for the fact that I consider myself an average man. And we don't just consider ourselves above average compared to a vaguely envisioned population of human beings at large. When put on a very small team, we tend to convince ourselves that we're more valuable than the average team member. In one study, academics who had worked on jointly authored research papers were asked what fraction of the team's output their own work accounted for. On the average four-person team, the sum of the claimed credit was 140%. The key word in the previous sentence is credit. When team efforts fail, our perceived contribution to the outcome shrinks. People are often aware of these forms of self-delusion. At least they're aware of them in other people. In one American study, experimenters described 8 different kinds of biases that are common in people, such as they tend to take credit for success but deny responsibility for failure. They see their successes as the result of personal qualities, like drive or ability, but their failures as the result of external factors, like unreasonable work requirements or inadequate instruction. In the case of all 8 biases, the average person said the average American is more susceptible than they themselves were. As Kurzban has summarized this finding, we think we're better than average at not being biased in thinking that we're better than average. Our egocentric biases are aided and abetted by the way memory works. Though certain painful events get seared into our memories, perhaps so we can avoid repeating the mistakes that led to them, we are on balance more likely to remember events that reflect favorably on us than those that don't. And we remember positive experiences in greater detail than negative experiences, as if the positive events are specially primed for sharing with the public in rich detail. No such asymmetry of narrative detail is found in our memory of positive and negative things that happen to other people. What's more, when we recount an experience to someone, the act of recounting it changes the memory of it. So if we reshape the story a bit each time, omitting inconvenient facts, exaggerating convenient ones, we can, over time, transform our actual belief about what happened, which presumably makes it easier to convince others that our story is true. Of course, people don't always have inflated conceptions of themselves. There is such a thing as low self-esteem. And there are explanations, speculative but plausible explanations, as to why it would make Darwinian sense for certain experiences to instill it. There are other differences as well among people that can influence the kinds of stories they tell and believe about themselves. In one study, people who ranked high on an extroversion scale and people who ranked high on a neuroticism scale both kept diaries about their everyday emotional experiences. Later, the extroverts recalled more positive experiences than they had in fact had, and the neurotics recalled more negative experiences than they had in fact had. This is proof that self-inflation, though the norm in our species, isn't an iron law. But note that both kinds of people were wrong. Their particular personalities had steered them toward different kinds of illusions. But in both cases, illusion is the operative word. The kinds of stories we tell about ourselves can also vary across cultures. Along some dimensions, Asians, on average, do less self-inflating than Westerners. Along other dimensions, notably collectivist virtues, such as loyalty to the group, Asians tend to do more self-inflating than Westerners. Still, the basic pattern of self-inflation holds worldwide, and that's particularly true when it comes to ethical virtues such as fairness. On average, people think they're morally above average. This is an especially important piece of self-flattery, because it helps fuel the self-righteousness that starts and sustains conflicts, ranging from quarrels to wars. So, all told, we're under at least 2 kinds of illusions. One is about the nature of the conscious self, which we see as more in control of things than it actually is. The other illusion is about exactly what kind of people we are, namely, capable and upstanding. You might call these two misconceptions the illusion about ourselves and the illusion about ourselves. They work in synergy. The first illusion helps us convince the world that we are coherent, consistent actors. We don't do things for no reason, and the reasons we do them make sense. If our behaviors merit credit or blame, there is an inner us that deserves that credit or blame. The second illusion helps convince the world that what we deserve is credit, not blame. We're more ethical than the average person, and we're more productive than the average teammate. We have benefactance. In other words, if you were to build into the brain a component in charge of public relations, it would look something like the conscious self. The anthropologist Jerome Barco has written, "It is possible to argue that the primary evolutionary function of the self is to be the organ of impression management, rather than, as our folk psychology would have it, a decision maker." The only thing I'd add is that the folk psychology itself may be part of the evolutionary function. Our presentation of ourselves as effective, upstanding people involves believing in the power of ourselves. Of many minds. If the conscious self isn't a CEO, directing all the behavior it thinks it's directing, how does behavior get directed? How do decisions get made? An increasingly common answer within the field of psychology, especially evolutionary psychology, is that the mind is modular. In this view, your mind is composed of lots of specialized modules. Modules for sizing up situations and reacting to them. And it's the interplay among these modules that shapes your behavior. And much of this interplay happens without conscious awareness on your part. The modular model of the mind, though still young and not fully fleshed out, holds a lot of promise. For starters, it makes sense in terms of evolution. The mind got built bit by bit, chunk by chunk. And as our species encountered new challenges, new chunks would have been added. As we'll see, this model also helps make sense of some of life's great internal conflicts, such as whether to cheat on your spouse, whether to take addictive drugs, and whether to eat another powdered sugar donut. Perhaps most important for our purposes, thinking of the mind as modular helps make sense of things you hear from Buddhist meditation teachers, such as that thoughts think themselves, and that appreciating this fact can be liberating. But the modular model of the mind has one big problem, its name. The word module begs to be misinterpreted. So before we get into the workings of the modular mind, let me try to preempt misunderstanding by listing three ways you shouldn't conceive of modules. 1. The modules aren't like a bunch of physical compartments. You can't point to one part of your brain and say, "This is the module that helps me infer what people are thinking from what they say and from their body language and facial expressions." Psychologists do think there's such a module, the theory of mind module. Autism has been linked to deficiencies in this module. But when scientists try to sketch out this module via brain scans, they find that it's far-flung, drawing on various regions of the brain, and sometimes drawing more on one region, sometimes more on another. 2. The different modules aren't like the blades on a Swiss Army knife or the apps on a smartphone. I say this with some hesitation because proponents of the modular paradigm sometimes use these very metaphors. But the truth is that there is much more interaction among and overlap between different mental modules than you see in a Swiss Army knife or even a smartphone. For example, some psychologists have argued that there is a cheater detection module that helps you figure out who you can trust. This module would presumably draw on the theory of mind module, but probably not on all of it. And it would probably draw on parts of the brain outside of it. It might, say, communicate with some kind of labeling module that gives people a negative or positive rating, depending on whether they pass the cheater test. To further complicate things, there are different kinds of cheaters to detect. There are transactional cheaters, the unscrupulous used car salesman, and there are sexual cheaters, mates who are unfaithful. Does it make sense to think of these two kinds of detection as being handled by a single module? There is likely some overlap between them. We might in both cases assess whether the person can look us in the eye while saying something we suspect is untrue. But the overlap isn't complete, because for one thing, the motivational systems that drive the cheater detection machinery differ in the two cases. Jealousy isn't what gets me to pay extra close attention to the facial expression of a used car salesman. And if I conclude he's untrustworthy, I don't fly into a jealous rage. Though, if I conclude this after the car has sold me dies, I might fly into a non-jealous rage. All told, the division of labor among, and delineation among, the modules in our mind is much less clear-cut than the word modules suggests. And the extent of interaction among them is greater than the word suggests. So if you'd rather use a word like networks or systems, feel free. 3. The modules aren't like departments in a company's organization chart. Maybe this goes without saying, given what I've just noted about how fluidly interactive and overlapping the modules are, and given that the whole context for this discussion is that our minds lack a CEO. Still, it's worth dwelling on how utterly unlike the idealized working of a corporation the operation of the mind is. Among the traits modules often lack are obedience and harmony. Yes, the modules may sometimes collaborate, but they sometimes compete, and they can compete fiercely. Someone once did a series of jokey organization charts for major corporations, and Microsoft, famous for its infighting, was depicted as a circular firing squad. Our minds aren't that torn by internal strife, but they're sometimes as close to that as to Microsoft's official organization chart. Kazaniga, the split brain experiment pioneer, has written, "While hierarchical processing takes place within the modules, it is looking like there is no hierarchy among the modules. All these modules are not reporting to a department head. It is a free-for-all, self-organizing system." There's a little tension in that last sentence. Free-for-all and self-organizing system have different connotations. Then again, the two terms don't have to be applied to the mind at the same time. Sometimes the mind feels like a free-for-all, and sometimes it feels more organized, as if the free-for-all has been resolved. What's more, the sense of organization is sometimes misleading, because the free-for-alls can happen at a subconscious level and can get resolved at that level. Whichever notion you happened to be conscious of at a particular moment is the one that comes bubbling up, the one that becomes dominant, writes Kazaniga. It's a dog-eat-dog world going on in your brain, with different systems competing to make it to the surface to win the prize of conscious recognition. When Kazaniga talks about the dog-eat-dog world inside your head, he isn't just talking about the obvious Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of internal struggle between the you who wants to eat a donut, or maybe even steal a donut, and the you who counsels restraint. In fact, with that kind of struggle, the conflict itself is often part of consciousness. We'll get into that kind of intermodular struggle in a later chapter, when I address the problem commonly known as self-control. Kazaniga is talking more about struggles that get resolved at an unconscious or barely conscious level. The things I pay attention to, the stories I tell about the things I pay attention to, the stories I tell about myself, all these result from choices getting made, and I, the conscious I, the thing I think of as myself, am, by and large, not making the choices. It's almost enough to make you wonder whether the thing you think of as yourself deserves that label. Korsban has written, "In the end, if it's true that your brain consists of many, many little modules with various functions, and if only a small number of them are conscious, then there might not be any particular reason to consider some of them to be you, or really you, or your self, or maybe anything else particularly special." When Korsban wrote that, in a book called Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution and the Modular Mind, he wasn't conversant with the Buddhist idea of not-self. But millennia after that idea arose, science had steered him toward it. I'd take issue with Korsban's suggestion that the conscious mind isn't special. The conscious mind is special, I'd argue, because it's, well, conscious. As such, it can feel pleasure and pain, joy and sadness. The capacity for feeling and for subjective experience in general is what gives life meaning and what gives valence to moral questions. If you imagine a planet full of human-like robots, incapable of subjective experience, would there be anything obviously wrong about destroying them, or anything obviously good about creating more of them? Still, the conscious mind, the conscious self, isn't special in the way we commonly assume it's special. It's not calling as many of the shots as we think it is. It's less like a president than like the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, who presides over votes and announces the outcome, but doesn't control the votes. Of course, the Speaker of the House may do some behind-the-scenes nudging, and so exert some influence over the votes. And we can't rule out the possibility that the conscious mind gets to do some nudging here and there. Indeed, you may find it useful to think of meditation as a process that takes a conscious mind that gets to do a little nudging and turns it into something that can do a lot of nudging. Maybe even turns it into something more like a president than a Speaker of the House. And you may, to that end, find it useful to understand how the brain determines which module is in charge at any given moment. That's the question we'll focus on in the next chapter.